Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. There's new leadership at Penn State Harrisburg, the largest satellite campus in the Penn State system with 5,000 students. Dr. John Mason is a Penn State Harrisburg graduate, and he joins us today. Dr. Mason, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity and the invitation.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Mason, usually, and we do this on a pretty frequent basis when we have new leadership at one of our colleges or universities, usually I'm introducing someone to the area or welcoming them to the area. Don't have to do that with you. You actually are a Penn State Harrisburg graduate, right?
Yes, that's correct. So it's more of a welcoming back would be a appropriate term, I would say.
Well, so you've made a long journey. I know you have been in Auburn University. You did some graduate work at Texas A&M. We'll talk about that. But what brought you back to Penn State Harrisburg? Why did you want to come back?
Well, there are situations in life that actually are true opportunities. As you said, being a graduate of the Penn State Harrisburg, and at that time it was called the Capital Campus, and we are now the Capital College, it truly was an opportunity at my point in my career. I was contacted maybe over a year ago, and people were saying, would you be interested in applying for the chancellorship? I had participated with the campus over the years in various alumni affairs, helped them with some of their campaign activities, stayed in contact with a lot of the faculty and students over the years. So to me, it was truly one of those things that when someone presents you with it, you give it consideration. And for me, very fortunately, it appears that they wanted me to come back, and I accepted the opportunity.
A lot has changed since it was known as Capital Campus in the early 70s. As I mentioned in the introduction, Penn State Harrisburg now second or largest satellite campus in the Penn State system. As you said, you participated in alumni events, so you've probably seen the campus over the years. But when you think back to when you were an undergraduate, a student at Capital Campus, and what Penn State Harrisburg is today, what are the changes that you see?
Well, they probably fall into at least two broad categories. One certainly is if you just look at the campus as a physical environment. At that time, it literally was one building, and there was a lot of open space throughout the campus area, two dormitories, and then Mead Heights actually had the buildings and the housing there. So I lived for a year in one of the dormitories, and then as a senior moved over to the Mead Heights area. So first of all, from a physical point of view, the Mead Heights buildings and properties are not there anymore, but that is an opportunity I hope we have a chance to talk about. But something that still is there that was very near and dear to me was I started out at the Penn State Allentown campus. And because of the connections between the faculty at Penn State Allentown and the faculty and staff at Penn State Harrisburg, when I was finishing my first 2 years, that connection, that personal connection, drew me to the Harrisburg area. And my point is, even though many decades have gone by, the idea that Penn State is one university, geographically distributed, and the connections between the faculty and staff at the different locations and the camaraderie of all those students is still there today. So while some physical things have changed, new buildings, excellent academic programs, I would say the idea that the Penn State University is very well connected throughout all its campus systems, I think, is something that has not changed. And I hope to sustain that and enhance that going forward.
In what ways? I mean, there are more than 20 satellite campuses with Penn State University. The degree, no matter which campus you graduate from, says the Pennsylvania State University. So it is a Penn State education that you are getting. But in what way is there that connection? And what is Penn State's Harrisburg role in this?
Well, there's a couple of aspects to that. One, literally by taking coursework, if you're in a particular degree area, there's a certainty that the course that you're taking in one campus is equivalent to a course at another campus, so that the degrees are a Penn State degree. Now, those things have varied over times, and we're hoping in the future there's even more continuity, that no matter what programs you would take, they'd be available to you for life. Another aspect of that is when you develop a relationship with the industries that actually employ some of our students, right? The curriculum that we have is being advised in different geographical areas. So you asked about the Penn State and Harrisburg campus. We have an advisory board that helps me and the campus and our academic programs understand what kind of needs there are in the region. So while it's one Penn State degree where the courses are transferable, the regional aspects of the campus allows you to pay attention to that geography, the future employers of our graduates. So I think in that respect, there is a differentiation between the regional needs, but at least the educational environment and the credential itself is one Penn State degree.
So what do you hear regionally? What are the careers? What are the jobs that are needed in this region that Penn State Harrisburg is educating students for?
Well, we have five schools, and the one thing that I must say that I've been very pleasant to hear is when I am out and about and talking to employers and some of our alums, the first thing they're saying, they want more of what we're producing. So, yeah, I would say
that's
that
a good thing.
If the issue was one that there was some gap or deficiency, I think the advisory board would help us identify that. So right now in our various programs that currently exist at Penn State Harrisburg, it appears that we're meeting not only a regional demand, but some of our students certainly leave the area, may take on jobs or go on to other academic careers, maybe getting advanced degrees. So I think we're doing a pretty good job of being responsive to the regional needs, because they're asking for more students in all of our five school areas.
But I was looking for a little more specifics as far as if you could name some of the industries, some of the careers in mm-hmm. which here in central Pennsylvania, they're saying, you know, this is what we really need.
Well, certainly in a technologically driven environment, anything in what's referred to as the STEM areas, the science, the technology, the engineering and mathematics area, that has been very much in need for the last few decades, and that's going to continue. So I would say the various employers, both public and private, that need that type of talent is certainly there. But we still have a need for our future teachers that have to be provided in the regional area. We have a School of Public Affairs that deals with all kinds of policy matters. We're right here in the state capitol. Another aspect I hear from our advisory board members, they want a student that has great breadth. So our humanities area certainly provides all that breadth and depth that provides a broader education for our students. Then in our business area, their students are being attracted by just about any business. Some of them are startup businesses that the students may want to start up their own small business. Other ones are going with very large business employers. So hopefully I've identified all five schools. I'm just saying there is a need and demand that is being supplied in all those areas.
When, obviously you're thinking about the future. As well. And you said that you don't have industries, business leaders coming to you, employers coming to you and say that you're missing something. But if you were to look down the road, are there majors? Are there careers that you can anticipate that there will be education for?
Yeah. I would say if there is a sense that I'm gaining, it's the interdisciplinarity. So my point is, we certainly need the depth in the various programs that we currently offer at Penn State Harrisburg in all those schools. But one thing that is being reinforced constantly by the people that recruit our students, they're looking for the ability that the students can cross over lines. And I'll give you an example. The health area is one of those. So the health industry now and in the future is not only the technological and the science sides of health, but there's the policy side, there's the business aspect side, and it's the humanitarian side that we have to deal with. So I would say, looking down the road, the health area is certainly one of them. And also things where we talk about smart technologies. It's embedded in everything we do. We're surrounded by it. So maybe the homes of the future might be integrating some of the smart technologies. One of those areas is, as we have an aging population, allowing some of the people to stay in their own home for an extended period of time. So if you look at it, the various schools can work together in something that provides a smart technology, but allow someone to stay in their home for an extended period of time. I think that's the kind of job market that will be seen in future, and hopefully Penn State Harrisburg is going to be positioned to provide that kind of knowledge.
Decisions made on majors and adding majors, the kind of education that you're offering, are those made in University Park? I mean, I guess my question is, can you, as the chancellor of Penn State, Harrisburg, say, here's something we'd like to add and go ahead and do it?
Well, I'll always qualify it with, we are one university geographically distributed. We have policies and procedures for all our academic matters. So as long as we follow the policy and procedures of the university, what I would say, though, we have the freedom to think, initiate, we put the programs together and they are properly reviewed, and then they go through the system, and as long as they meet all the criteria that's expected of a quality education, we do have that independence. But I must say, I think there is some benefit to having, it's not so much oversight, but coordination, and I think that coordination is something that's benefited the entire Penn State system.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, more than 20 satellite campuses. We know that amongst colleges and universities, there's competition. Is there competition amongst the satellite campuses for students? Or is it based on geography, depending on where they want to go or what career, what major they want to pursue?
Yeah, I'll say I think you answered the part of the question.
See, I should have kept my mouth shut.
I think it's back. I'll personalize and go back to myself. I started at the Allentown campus because it gave me the opportunity to work and pay for my tuition and take those programs. So it was a geographic decision.
You're from Allentown area.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. I would say, so all the campuses are going to have some of those, they're serving those students in that geographic region. I would say at Penn State Harrisburg, while we're serving the central Pennsylvania region, we have over 800 students that come from 50 countries from around the world. We also have a good proportion, I think it's about 15 to 20% that may be out-of-state students, but the majority are still in-state students. They're in the regional area. So I think we're fortunate to have a good balance of an international population, a regional population, and some where the region goes beyond our state boundaries, and we're very excited about that.
So basically you're telling me that there isn't a lot of competition. You're working together with the satellite
That's
campuses.
Correct.
But what I had said, my original statement about competing for students, does Penn State Harrisburg have to compete for students? And I'm not talking about with the other satellite campuses,
right,
but with the state-related universities or the state-owned universities or the private liberal arts colleges.
Well, let me approach it this way. We are seeing an ever-increasing pool of applicants. So one indicator is while there may be competition in the sense of competition for the individual student, I pursue my dialogue with the schools that we should be differentiating ourselves. We'd like to collaborate and work with others. But if we only go into a competitive mode, what we're really doing is fighting for headcount. So why don't we create excellence in our academic programs? The academic programs will attract the type of students that we need and want. Right now, we are very fortunate. Our application pool is exceeding right now. I can't remember the exact number, but we certainly had an increase in the number of applications that are coming to our campus.
You denied applications, had to decide on a limit?
Well, they would be limited by their qualifications to meet the curriculum requirements.
Right.
So I'm saying we're not capping any particular program and saying we can only accept so many. But I'm saying as long as the application pool is meeting our enrollment and we're approaching over 5,000 students at this point in time, I think we're in good shape. So the competition may be for headcount. I'm saying we're differentiating ourselves by the quality of our academic programs we offer.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. John Mason. He's the chancellor, the new chancellor of Penn State Harrisburg. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll be talking about a lawsuit that's been filed by a group of young people, including one here in central Pennsylvania, with Tents College here in central Pennsylvania, against the federal government, asking is asking the government to make some changes when it comes to climate change. That's coming up a little bit later in the program. So, Dr. Mason, we were talking about some of the changes that have occurred at Penn State Harrisburg over the years. And yes, the campus looks much different today. You were also talking about the number of applications that you are not at a shortage for getting applications from students. I ask about competition. There almost seems like, I hate to put it in these terms, but an arms race between universities for newer, bigger, better dorms, laboratories, classrooms. Those are the kind of things that students are looking for. I have to admit that in Penn State Harrisburg's case, it may be just that the college is growing. Mm-hmm. But at University Park, main campus, I constantly am seeing building going on, new buildings. Is there an arms race? I mean, you probably don't like that terminology, but do you have to compete for students that way?
Well, I'm going to go back to the point I made earlier. The thing that I felt very comfortable with when I arrived on campus is that the students that I would be meeting, they would very quickly gravitate to the question I would ask them of, why did you come to Penn State Harrisburg? I'll give you a very simple example. My wife and I and our daughter were on campus together during move-in day. And so we went into some of the dormitories that we have, and I just asked some of the students and their faculty, why did they pick Penn State Harrisburg? And some of them were from out of state. When they tell me that they came here because their child was interested in a particular academic program, right, that justifies the attractiveness to our campus. So it's not so much a race for the number of students or the race to grow the campus. It means that what we have to offer is what people want. And I think that's the way to pursue it, that if you have quality programs and the demand for the jobs are there, the students do gravitate to it. We do have one limitation, and the limitation is while we're a growing campus, right? We're up to around 5,000 students. And that seems to be the number that we have quality delivery of the educational programs. We do have the ability to accept and attract more students. What we'll need then, though, is obviously the facilities and the faculty and the dormitories. The last point I want to make is, while we were primarily a commuter campus, we do not have all the resident dormitories that the students would like. There is actually a waiting list that students want to live in a residence life where they can be close to campus and have that security and activity. So when you say about the race, it's almost impossible to keep up with some of the demand, so you have to do it in an evolutionary fashion. And that's what's happening at Penn State Harrisburg. We have a capacity right now. We're going to keep evolving, but it's not like we're trying to double or triple over a certain period of time.
Here's a big question. What's your vision for Penn State Harrisburg?
Well, there's three elements to that. One is I want to continue, keep emphasizing the academic excellence. Because of the quality faculty we have, we're attracting quality students, and we have quality staff that make all these things possible. So my vision is we do not want to disturb that. We want to grow it. So I want to listen to what are the demands of our society for our students. The other area is growing our research and scholarship. In order to have quality academic programs, you need faculty and staff working on cutting-edge ideas. They bring that into the curriculum. They develop a program that attracts the students. The last part is I'm very interested in working in a public-private partnership. We need to continually engage the public and private sector around our campus. So hopefully we'll actually have more growth where we're actually working with projects for the industry or something in the health area. So all three of those are on my vision screen.
Along those same lines, I'm always interested in what an institution, many colleges and universities are anchor institutions in their communities. As you said, Penn State Harrisburg traditionally has been a commuter school. It's hard to be an anchor institution. I think what you were describing earlier, you would like to be that way with these private, public-private partnerships.
Correct.
Relationship that Penn State Harrisburg has with the community, not just Middletown, Harrisburg, but the surrounding areas. What kind of relationship do you have now? What would you like to see?
Well, as you might imagine, while I said I'm returning, I am new to the system, having literally, you know, left and lived and worked elsewhere, participating with their local Chamber of Commerce on their board. So I'm listening and learning to what we can do from that perspective. In these public-private partnerships, getting to meet a lot of the companies that might be interested in establishing a longer-term working relationship with our students. We're anticipating in the fall of the year to actually have an event on campus where the entire on-campus community and the surrounding community can come to our campus and literally see what we're doing on campus, enjoy some events on the campus. So it'd be more of a town and gown relationship. So I think there's something that should happen very regionally that's very local. But on the other aspect, our region is quite large. When you say the Harrisburg region,
right. It
is quite large. So I'm getting to learn a lot more about what's going on in this entire central Pennsylvania area.
Let's take some phone calls. Diane is in Harrisburg. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Chancellor, I'm wondering if Penn State Harrisburg offers a cybersecurity program. I believe my 19-year-old son was looking at Penn State Harrisburg last year when he graduated from high school. He wants to get into cybersecurity, but a number of the requisite courses along those lines were not offered in Harrisburg. Are you aware of that, of whether or not it's offered in Harrisburg?
Well, we have a homeland security area that has aspects of cybersecurity, but as an individual singular cybersecurity program, we don't have that on our campus at this particular time. But that is definitely, as you just stated, a growing need. And I said that goes back to that STEM area, but it has the aspects of being interdisciplinary, that cybersecurity is not only the technological side, but it's going to be cross-cutting. But that's a good piece of input, and I'm going to take that back to our campus, and we're going to think about that.
Diane, thank you very much for your call. And I was thinking the exact same thing, that there is not a day that goes by that you do not hear about some kind of security breach. And I mean, obviously, we're talking about foreign countries interfering with the elections and that kind of thing. So that would seem to be an area where, or an industry that really needs some help or some more students, more people who are majoring in those areas. Let's go to John in Camp Hill. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
Chancellor, I'm curious. You talk a lot about the integration with University Park and it being all one system, but the one area that I know there's a huge discrepancy in, it comes with athletics. And the branch campuses, the funding inequities, in University Park you've got a program that's got hundreds of millions of dollars and making huge profits and beautiful, wonderful facilities, but the branch campuses play their events in facilities that are on par with high schools, and you've got coaches having to fundraise for even things as basic as compression shorts for underneath their uniforms. How do you address that, and how do you kind of rectify that so that those kids feel like they actually are a part of Penn State when they're playing sports and representing Penn State University?
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Chancellor.
Well, thank you for the question. And as a Division III school, I'm certainly learning about both the needs and some of the complications that we face because the Division III NCAA rules and regulations certainly limit activities compared to a Division I school, so that brings in all the financial aspects. Literally just met with our athletic director a few days ago. Constantly going to be looking at and improving the experience that our students have. We want our student athletes to have a positive and an academic experience at Penn State Harrisburg. But on many of the items you just raised, I am going to be working with our development officers and others, and we're going to try to improve the quality of the activities in athletics and recognize the dilemmas we have. But at this point in time, we're simply trying to focus on the experience that the students have, and hopefully that'll carry us into the future.
How important is that? I mean, let's face it, there are, for some students, it's very important as part of them. But for the university, for Penn State Harrisburg, how important is not just sports, yeah, but other activities?
Well,
like that?
As I said, it's on my radar screen, and it's a priority. Without getting into too many details, the issue that I was discussing with the athletic director, many of our coaches are part-time coaches. So are we arriving at a point in time that we have to look at what proportion are full-time versus part-time, and maybe we have to start looking at more full-time coaches? Then when you have the full-time coaches, in addition to the experience that they're coaching the students, right, they're available for some other administrative help to help grow the overall program. So it's going to be a transition, and it certainly is a balancing act. But we definitely want to attract the students that have an athletic interest and background, but I want to make sure their experience is both an academic experience as well as an excellent athletic experience.
We have an email from Michael who says, I get tired of the Harrisburg area's inferiority complex. He says, I'm a native of Harrisburg, especially in the size of the area. It's a top 100 metro area in the U.S. And when the Harrisburg area attempted to get the Amazon headquarters location, many locals said, we can't compete with other areas in the United States and high-tech workers. And he says, what, with the question mark and exclamation point, I don't believe that is true. Does your guest?
Well, I'm only back here the last couple of months, and I'm trying to get some better data. But as I said, when I look at the students and where they're being employed, we certainly have the quality, and we have a workforce that can deliver it. The issue may be the numbers. Are we producing literally enough of the headcount, not just Penn State Harrisburg, but you know the state in general, about the quality of the workforce that we have? I would say, though, I'll go back to my public-private partnership. In this Harrisburg area, given what we're doing at the Penn State Harrisburg campus, we should be able to show that we can work in a very competitive environment going forward.
Dr. Mason, one of the issues that many students face and their families is the affordability of a college education. Penn State Harrisburg's tuition similar or the same as main campus?
The campuses vary a little bit, but for all practical purposes, we're in the general same area throughout the Commonwealth.
What do we do about affordability?
Well, for me, is we can certainly look at all the revenue streams that come in and fight those battles, and we have to continue to do that. We try to look at cost controls. The whole university system is looking at different ways to manage our costs. But sooner or later, you get to a price point. In order to deliver a certain quality education, the facilities, the faculty, the staff, and all the supporting services need to be satisfied. That drives the tuition. That's what the trustees have to establish, the tuition base. Where do I work it? From the development side, we are very fortunate of all our friends and alums that are givers to the university. We now have about 80% of our enrolled students receive some financial aid in some way, shape, or form. We have to continue to offset those costs, and part of our philanthropy work is solving that. Some other things we're doing is working with students on internships. Another opportunity is maybe not being on campus continuously. You can take some courses through the World Campus. And another thing is we always worry about time to degree. For some of our students, their time to degree is dependent upon the resources. So they're able to take their courses over maybe a longer period of time as part-time students. So I guess to solve the problem is we have to look at it in a multifaceted way. It's not only controlling the tuition costs. That is something we've been trying to do as a university. There's been several freezes on the tuitions. On the other hand, those other costs have to be offset. And I think there's several ways that we can handle that.
You need more help from the state? Financially?
I would be remiss to say that we don't, but we certainly do. I think the gap, though, sometime has to be an imbalance between what resources can be provided for the state, look at the products that we're delivering, but we have to work it in many different avenues. I don't think there's one simple solution here.
Dr. John Mason is the Chancellor of Penn State Harrisburg. Dr. Mason, thank you very much for being with us today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday's Smart Talk, James and Deborah Fallows, authors of the book Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. It's about cities and towns that they visited that are success stories. Not all of them are success stories, but many are. And some of the very characteristics that make them success stories are consistent throughout the country. It's an interesting book and an interesting conversation that's coming up on Monday Smart Talk. In 2015, 21 young people ranging in age from 8 to 19 filed a lawsuit against the federal government saying the government hasn't acted to stop climate change, even though it has been aware of what causes it for years. As part of a nonprofit called Our Children's Trust, they're arguing that they're being denied due process, meaning that their future rights to life, liberty, and property are threatened because although the government knows burning fossil fuels causes climate change, it takes actions that promote the use of fossil fuels. One of the plaintiffs in the case is a Dickinson College sophomore, Sophie Kivilahan. Sophie Kivilahan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also joining us on the program is Dr. Neil Leary. He's director of Dickinson Center for Sustainability Education. Dr. Leary, good to see you too.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And on the phone, Aowyn Saran, who is our Children's Trust Trial Outreach Coordinator. Ms. Aowyn, welcome to the program.
Good morning from Eugene, Oregon.
I thought you were in Oregon. So thanks for getting up early in the morning for us on the West Coast. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Sophie Kivilahan, let me start with you. It was 2015, 4 years ago. Now you're a sophomore at Dickinson College. Then you were in high school. Why did you participate or decide to participate in this lawsuit, and what were you looking for?
Yeah, I was very lucky to grow up with a very well-known, very famous climate scientist as a grandfather. And
Dr. James Hansen.
Yes, Dr. James Hansen. Hello. And he was very supportive and very gentle growing up about teaching me about climate science without scaring me, which is very, it seems like an impossible feat in hindsight, but he's done it. And so I was just very inspired to continue the work that he was doing, and mostly coming to college, even in the end of high school, but especially coming to Dickinson, realizing how many people in the world hadn't grown up with something like that, which sounds naive now, saying out loud, but I just had this epiphany coming to college, like, wow, I'm so surprised that not everyone has had this access to information, and it wasn't something I could just sit on.
But why enter into a lawsuit? I mean, there are a lot of people, obviously, around the world who are concerned about this issue, but why a lawsuit?
Right, yeah, it seems like counterintuitive, maybe. It's kind of an argument that should be made in front of Congress. That's where it naturally fits. But when arguments are made in Congress that aren't being resolved, it is the judicial branch. It's their job to kind of act as a check on the other two branches when they're not doing their job. So that was just the next step.
I don't want to call it a last resort, but yeah. When basically what you just described is Congress won't act on the issue. Most of it's political, but won't act on the issue. This was in 2015. President Obama was still in office at the time. Even though the Obama administration was taking some steps toward reducing greenhouse gases, and it was on their radar, top of the radar of climate change. It was filed in 2015, but now the Trump administration has undone a lot of the things that the Obama administration did. So I get the sense that you probably see the suit as more important even now.
Yes. I mean, it was, of course, important then. When we filed it under Obama, we were more filing it under the administrations in general for failing to take that responsibility that they have to their young people and their nation. But actually, yes, it is some of Obama's policies were unfortunately not being carried out as well as they should have been. And I don't blame that on him, but more his science advisors. So we were still confident filing it then that we would have had a good outcome. But yeah, seeing the switch in the defense team from when it was under Obama to under Trump, it's much easier to argue against someone who's saying that the science isn't even relevant than to someone who's saying that it's relevant and they're doing what they can, even if what they can is not enough.
Ms. Saron, you're not an attorney, but you're a trial outreach coordinator with Our Children's Trust. First of all, what is Our Children's Trust, just to provide a little bit of context there?
Great question. Our Children's Trust was founded in 2011, and its primary goal is to elevate the voices of young people. And we do so primarily through the judicial branch of government, through our courts, and by bringing lawsuits across the United States, state lawsuits, and then this federal lawsuit, Giuliana versus the U.S.
Giuliana, by the way, just so people don't think it's the first name is Rudy, it's a different name anyway, but that was the first student, and that was part of the lawsuit, correct?
Correct, yes. Kelsey Giuliana is the lead plaintiff in the case out of the 21.
Okay. So without getting into every step of what has happened in the 4 years, where do you stand now as far as the court case goes?
Yeah, great question. So we were supposed to go to trial in the federal district court in Eugene, Oregon in October last year. Our experts were all ready. We had climate scientists, including Sophie's grandfather, James Hansen, economists, policy experts, working pro bono. And 2 weeks before we were supposed to go to trial, the defendants submitted a series of appeals, and the courts issued a temporary stay on the case pending the appellate process, preventing us from going to trial. Now, the stay has been lifted, but in December, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals took up the case on a really unusual appeal made by the defendants called interlocutory appeal. So we are scheduled to appear at a hearing during the first week of June, and the Ninth Circuit Court will review the district court's previous findings that allowed the case to go to trial and then rule on this appeal.
So just so everyone knows, and I'll provide some context throughout the program, that the defendants in this case are the Trump administration.
Correct.
Okay. So, again, without getting too into the weeds as far as the legalities, what is the suit asking for?
The suit is asking for the courts to order a climate recovery plan, so that, to order the federal government, the executive branch, to create and implement a science-based climate recovery plan that will return our carbon emissions down so that our CO2 levels are at a healthy level by the year 2100.
So, you know, I'm listening to that, and I'm thinking that a lot of people will be looking for responsibilities, constitutional duties of the branches of government. Wouldn't a court then, what you're asking is, there would probably be some people who would say that you're asking a court to legislate because you're asking them to implement policy, the executive branch.
Yeah, that's also a great question. So we have seen in the past where the courts have stepped in the past to hold the legislative and executive branches of government accountable when they've taken actions that the courts believe are harming the citizens of America. And so we saw that in Brown v. Board of Education, for example, with segregation in schools, and the courts actually ordered the government to come up with a desegregation plan over a period of time for our schools.
So would you, when someone would say, well, you're asking courts to set policy, what do you say to that? I mean, you gave an example of where you think there is a precedent. But, I mean, obviously it would be much easier if Congress or the president would come up with policy.
You know, that would be great. But unfortunately, no policy that they have come up with to deal with the extent and the severity of climate change, especially when it comes to our nation's role in causing climate change has really been enough. So that's when we believe the court should step in and intervene and help them set policies, oversee them setting policies that will actually measure up to the scope of the problem.
I probably am not going too far when I say that part of this is you're basing it on the future of the planet, the health and safety of those who are living on the planet at this time.
Correct. This is all about the plaintiff's constitutional rights as young people to life, liberty, and property. By protecting them from the effects of climate change, because they're going to bear the brunt of it, and the government has taken actions to harm them.
Dr. Neil Leary is the director of Dickinson Center for Sustainability Education. Dr. Leary, our Children's Trust, the nonprofit here, was the recipient of Dickinson's Award for Global Environmental Activism, the 2018 Rose Walters Prize. Why?
Yes, yeah, so the Rose Walters Prize was established a few years ago by Sam Rose, a graduate of Dickinson College from 1958, and his wife, Julie Walters. And the prize is intended to bring attention to amplify voices of people who are working on environmental issues, working on behalf of the planet and its inhabitants. So we've given the prize a number of years. This year's prize winner is our Children's Trust. There were another number of factors which made our prize committee think that this was an excellent organization for us to recognize this year. One of which is just the importance of the work that our Children's Trust is doing. Trying to give voice to these young people. I think all of them at the time when the suit started were not of voting age.
They were 8 yet, to 19 years old.
Yeah. So,
Sophie was in high school.
So, you know, they're unable to influence that policy process that you referred to. And our Children's Trust is giving them a way to be heard and heard in a very visible forum by bringing a federal lawsuit. And this is work that it's vitally important. It's important that it aligns with Dickinson's commitment to sustainability. It also really resonates with our students. That was a big factor. That it is, you know, a lawsuit in which the plaintiffs are of college age or near college age, addressing an issue that Dickinson students and many college students feel like we're not behaving responsibly as a society. We're not doing what we need to do. So that made our Children's Trust an interesting choice for the prize. Also playing into it is we investigated our Children's Trust a bit, and we found out this was in the summer of 2017, and we learned that one of the plaintiffs was Sophie, who was going to be starting at Dickinson that fall as a first-year student. We then also learned that Sophie's grandfather is Dr. James Hansen, eminent climate scientist. We've had a relationship with him in the past. We give another award called the Joseph Priestley Award. We had given that to Dr. Hansen a few years before, and he had given a talk on campus and had a huge impact with our students. So mm-hmm. That was another connection. One last thing was we then learned that there's a Dickinson graduate from 1968 who is a professor of environmental law at West Virginia University, and it turns out he's on the board of our Children's Trust. So when these things
connections.
A lot of connections. The work is important. The work resonates with our students, and there are these connections to Dickinson, and it was clear this was an excellent choice for the prize this year.
Again, just for background purposes, Sophie's grandfather, Dr. James Hansen, is a professor who directs the program on climate science, awareness, and solutions of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. And as mentioned, Dr. Hansen has a reputation globally for working on this issue. I am curious, though, Dr. Leary, when Sophie said that she was a bit surprised when she got to Dickinson and saw that not everyone had a grandfather who was world-renowned in this area, that maybe not all students, or a lot of students, were educated in this area, knew a whole lot about it. Mm-hmm. What about now? Do they? I mean, is this an issue? Is climate change an issue that students at Dickinson, other college students, college-age students, are saying this is important to us, and not just, and that they know something about it?
I would say that the vast majority of students would say that this is an issue that's important to them. Many of them have a knowledge base from which they're able to think about how we should respond to it. Not as strong of a knowledge base as we'd like to see. That's part of why we have made educating our students about climate change an important part of what we're doing at Dickinson. A number of years ago, we got a grant from NASA, a $500,000 grant. We were the only small liberal arts college to get one of these climate change education grants from NASA. We ran programs for our faculty to help educate them about how to teach about climate change. And we were educating faculty from, I think it was 60 or 70 colleges or universities around the country were coming to Dickinson College to interact with us to talk about and figure out ways, how can we do a more effective job about educating about climate change? Mm-hmm. It's a strong need. It's something we need to do more of. Our students are coming to Dickinson each year with more background and more knowledge than their predecessors. But they're still, you know, actually having exposure to the science and not just the politics of it. You know, that's something that we need to be making progress on.
Unfortunately, in this country, the politics of it is often what is focused on rather than talking about the science. I mean, we hear that figure often, that 97% of scientists think that this is happening. I mean, we are one of the few countries in the world where we're still having the debate of actually whether the climate is changing or not. Maybe the only country. Rachel is in McSherrystown. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having this program. I support the lawsuit.
Thank you.
I support the environment. One of the things that people don't seem to understand when they're talking about climate change and environment and pollution is that what we eat has a great effect on the environment. And in particular, I'm a vegan, and I'm aware that politicians are fueled by corporations and their donations, and animal agriculture in this country, because of representatives in states who pass laws, they do not have to report their methane emissions to the EPA. 51 other organizations have to, but not animal ag. That tells you how corporations are running politics. And what we eat does have an effect on the environment, and all the manure that these animals produce, they're running into the soil, the air, the water, and polluting oceans. So it's much more than just corporate smokestacks and things like that. We have to look at what we're consuming. And more people are going vegan because of this issue, because of the pollution to the environment.
I'm almost running out of time. Hey, thank you very much. The point she makes, we probably could list 100 things that have made contributions, but the point that she makes is, that's why this is so big, what you're talking about, is that the federal government is involved in a lot of different things. So, I don't know. I guess, Ms. Ron, I'll ask you this question. Because the federal government is so big, I mean, are you actually looking for the government to implement programs, stop programs, stop using fossil fuels, reduce fossil fuels? Just what?
Yeah, so what our lawsuit is asking for is the courts to oversee the federal government as they create a nationwide plan for our energy system to transition us off of fossil fuels to almost 98% and therefore reduce our atmospheric CO2 by doing that. So this is the opportunity to bring about broad systemic change by reforming our entire energy system and really preventing catastrophic climate change.
By the way, I just got a note here from Bucknell that Sophie and her grandfather, Dr. James Hansen, will be keynote speakers at the 7th Annual Sustainability Symposium at Bucknell University on Friday, April 26th and Saturday, April 27th. So, Sophie, you and your grandfather are getting around on this.
Yeah, we're trying our best.
So you're a tag team, huh?
I suppose so.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. So, Sophie, I kind of wanted to follow up on what Dr. Leary had said and to follow up on what you had said earlier. Are you noticing that your colleagues in school, that this is becoming more of a significant issue for them? Would you like to be more, would you like them to be more involved in the issue?
Absolutely. I'm both. I'm noticing people every day becoming more aware, but the biggest issue that I see personally is not knowing what to do with that awareness, not knowing, like, it's not like we're all climatologists understanding or all politicians knowing how, like, all we feel like we can do is just vote once in a while, you know? So supporting the lawsuit is great. Joining local organizations like Citizens Climate Lobby, the Sierra Club, places like that are great things to have, like, a dynamic youth join those, that older group of people, those social media experts creating a better, more colorful movement towards something.
Well, we're out of time. We only have about 30 seconds. But a quick question, I had a listener ask, are you off the grid? Do you try to conserve?
Yeah. My house has solar panels. My grandparents' house has solar panels. Okay. My carbon footprint is very small.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Coming up on Monday's program, we talk with James and Deborah Fallows, best-selling authors, talking about American cities and towns that are success stories.